All right, welcome back to the show. Thank you guys so much for joining us. And we've got a special guest, one of my favorites. You know, it's one of my favorite guys to talk to. None other than the Wild Canadian himself, Mr. Kevin Muir of East West Cap. Hey, you know what, Kevin? Before I screw that up, it's East West Capital, right?
No, it's East West Investment Management.
East West Investment Management. Okay, and then right out of the gate, I would strongly suggest you guys have heard me be a shill for Twitter. One of my favorite follows, absolutely, and to get access and the current updated info of the macro tourist blog, truly one of the things that we never miss. And I would suggest you guys read it too. And you can follow him at Kevin Muir on M-U-I-R on Twitter, at Kevin Muir. And how else could the folks follow your thoughts? I know you're not a guy that believes that your thoughts are, you know, you've got a very in-line sense of self, so you're not a self-promoter. But where can the folks follow you?
Well, my tagline is, all I bring to the party is 25 years of mistakes. So I'm probably going to do some more, but you can join me while I do some more at themacrotourist.com. And you can sign up. That's a free blog post that I don't write as much as I should. I used to write a lot more, but you'll still see updates there.
And right out of the gate, I got to say this, because this is one of the reasons we love having you on. And you and I have spoken about this before. It used to make me mad. I think I was probably young and immature. But as I get older now, these guys that present themselves as, you know, like a Zeus-like figure of modern finance, right? They've never had a bad trade and do what I say. And we all know the kind. I just always chuckle because I immediately write off what they're going to say. You, on the other hand, come out and go, hey, all I've got is mistakes. And my ears perk up and I'm like, hey, this guy's somebody to follow.
That's true, and I'm always shocked at the new ways of making mistakes that I can find.
But Kevin, now this isn't what I wanted to have you on for, but this is an interesting topic that I think is it's something that a lot of professional investors don't have a handle on, and I know that the vast majority, 98-99% of retail investors don't have a handle on this. This is a game. It's like baseball in a sense. If it's your batting average, you're gonna have strikeouts, you're gonna have misses, and I'm sure you would echo this sentiment that you're never gonna stop having them, and you're gonna constantly be learning. And haven't those mistakes guided you in a lot of ways more than the successes?
You're absolutely right, because you need to learn from them. It's only a mistake if you fail to learn from it. And I always kind of say it's a little bit like a casino. A casino, you go to the casino and the odds favor the house. But it's not like they win every trade or win every bet. In fact, they lose a whole bunch of them. But what they do is they try to do the bet over and over again. And at the end of the night, they're ahead in terms of the amount of money in their coffers. And if you do the same and you apply the same discipline to trading and investing, you can hopefully do the same, have the same outcome.
Yeah, no, I think to me, you know, as I've gone along in my career, and in all terms and all definitions, I'm still early in my career. More senior than most. I don't feel that way, and the gray hair is coming in thick and fast. So,
well, at least you still have hair. I don't anymore.
That's true.
It was the JGB short did it. I lost it all then.
Oh, the old Widowmaker. Did you really do that? Did you do the Widowmaker?
Oh, I had my time doing shorting the JGBs for sure. You can't call yourself a macro trader unless you lost money shorting JGBs.
Oh, well, maybe I should hop in there and try it.
Well, nowadays the newer version one is the Bund, the German Bund. That's the one that everyone loses money on. Now, having said that, you know, it did take Bill Gross out of the game. You know, in his second iteration outside of PIMCO, he's with Janus. When he talks about what his kind of regrets were, it was the fact that he went too big on that trade and he got stopped out. The really interesting thing about that is it actually, as a spread trade, because don't forget, he had it on versus he was short Bunds and long U.S. Treasuries. I think that he basically tapped out right before the U.S. Treasury went on one of the biggest runs in terms of bull markets that we've seen in a long time.
That was a melt your face off rally.
For sure. The summer was actually, even though when you looked at the kind of the paper and looked at the stock index averages and you thought, oh, not much happened this summer, you could be fooled into that kind of a sense. But reality on the fixed income side in the bond market, it was an epic rally that will go down in the history books.
Yeah, that was a screamer. You know, and we didn't catch all of that one, but I'm not going to lie to you. Some of my favorite trades and best trades have been the ones that I expected the least from. And I remember, I mean, I think the 10-year topped out in this one that we're talking about. Didn't the 10-year, was it 325? Was that where it was at?
Well, I think that was the famous Gundlach, the two closes below, above 3.25, and he was going to get really bearish. But I think that's the 30-year, isn't it? Let me just have a look here.
No, the 10-year. The 10-year got up to 3.25, I think.
Oh, you're absolutely right. Yeah. It was 3.25 as of a year ago on October 30th. The 10-year U.S. Treasury was 3.25, and that went from 3.25 all the way down to 142 in the next year.
So, knowing with our level of expertise, we were able to go long at 325 and we sold at 142. I'm joking. No, we didn't get on it till I want to say like 2.9. It was like 2.91 or something like that. And I bought it more as just a buffer in the portfolio. And watching that sucker run was just, it kept catching me off guard where you're sitting there going, man, that looked timely, you know, but, you know, it worked out better. I didn't think we were going to make a run down to 142. It blew me away.
Well, and even more shocking than the U.S. one was what was happening in Europe and Japan and other kind of global fixed income markets where it just went, it went negative and it got even more negative to the point where, people were talking about 100-year bonds from Austria that represented such great value at like 70 basis points.
Yeah, I know. And then, the performance of the, I've never played with it. So I'm forgetting the term, but the long bond, the one last year that was up like 33% or something, the no yield long bond.
Like the zero coupon.
There you go. Zero coupon bond. I mean, that thing just ripped. Incredible.
Yeah. And I think that's the biggest story and worry for investors going forward is this idea. Now, you mentioned it, the fact that you used it as a buffer in your portfolio, and it did work this time. But what really scares me, kind of thinking about the next 10 or 20 years, is that relationship, that negative correlation between stocks and bonds, what happens when that goes away?
Oh.
And I think that is the next kind of financial crisis will occur, not from stocks, but actually from sovereign bonds. And I always say that, after being through a few bubbles in my day, I always think it's funny that people tell me, oh, if I was around, I would have known the dot-com was a bubble. Well, I was there, and I can tell you it was very difficult to fight the dot-com bubble. Like, everyone was telling you how, the more they spent, the more it was gonna change the world, and how if you didn't own it, you were a fool. Even Stanley Druckenmiller, he had tried to fight it, and then eventually he pulled the plug and he ended up going long at the top. And he's a famous trader, probably the best trader that's ever lived. And he made the mistake of getting sucked into the bubble. Then we go to the credit bubble of 2006 or 7, and at that time, we have these situations where the Big Short, and it seems very simple. Oh, look at all these guys made all this money. They forget that there was many years of guys trying to short it the whole way up, and they just happened to make the guys that got it at the end, the guys that still had some chips and were still able to bet against it, those were the guys that made the movie.
Right.
But everybody else got taken out. And I'll tell you, bubbles are very, very difficult, and especially when you're in them. And if everybody's telling you you're in a bubble, that's probably not the bubble that you're actually in. So I look at the fixed income, and I look at this crazy move in Europe where you have rates that are minus 50 on the 10-year bund. And I say to myself, how is this not a bubble? How, by this very definition, the only way you're going to make money in boons is literally to sell them to someone else at an even more negative yield. And so when I think about what a bubble is, that it it's pretty clear to me that we're in the Ponzi stage of the fixed income bubble, where when your investments are all based upon the price action or the fact that someone, the greater fool theory, that there'll be somebody that's even willing to do it at a more negative yield, it's very clear to me that we're in a fixed income bubble, and especially in Europe and Japan. And I find the fact that nobody's willing to say it, and when I say we're in a fixed income bubble, there's pushback on it. It just leads me to believe that those are the telltale signs that we are in a bubble, because when you're in them, nobody is willing to recognize them.
Oh, 100%. And it's the ultimate evolution of, you know, the greater fool theory. And you know, like we joked around when I was on the market huddle, you know, what do you even call this stuff now? You got an asset class called fixed income, and it's fixed expense. You know, it's
yeah.
And I want to be very clear to the listeners. When we talked about putting that bond trade on, it was just that. It was a trade. And we've said it on the show. I heard an interview recently with Mark Spitznagel, author of Dow of Money. And he said it, in my opinion, he said it perfectly. He said, listen, the only way that you should deploy bonds in a portfolio anymore is tactical, right? Over short periods of time based on certain events. And even then, be careful. He just said that, you know, long term, like you said, I mean, the asset class is called fixed income and they're buying things that have negative yields. I mean, you know, how do you, it's just a wild world. And this goes into our whole, you know, for the retail investors, obviously, you know, for the hedge fund guys out there, there's all these other kind of things. But this is one of the reasons that we're pounding the table on the bond portfolio, because on a risk adjusted basis, there's so many things we can do with that money where we can do it cheaper and we can get much higher rates of return at much less risk. And you see these portfolios, especially in the retail world, Kevin, where they're just sucking wind and they're looking at the stocks. And I go, guys, 40%, 50%. I had a client move over to us. Listen to this. I had a client move over to us, had about $1 million portfolio, Morgan Stanley. They're charging him 1.6% a year. And that's just the advisory fee. They were all mutual funds. So you got 12 B1s in front of that. He had a 50-50 stock bond portfolio. And I just,
wow.
I looked at that and went, that is, talk about highway robbery. And, you know, I would have flipped it around and said, you know what, man, you'd be better off getting the advisory fee on those bonds than the return of those bonds. You know what I mean? You know what I mean, though?
That's a good line.
And like you said, the more nervous people get, we keep watching. I sit there and look at these retail portfolios all the time, where the advisor is trying to respond to the client's fear about Trump impeachment and all these other different things, and so they're sucking money out of the equity portfolio and increasing the bond holdings. And I'm just like, guys, this is nuts.
Yeah, it's very difficult because it's not like stocks are cheap either. So then the question is, where do you hide? What do? And you do need to figure out some different kind of asset classes and try to find different strategies or tactics that might work. And I actually think that Spitznagel comment is great. That's a great way of thinking about bonds. You can't ever put them in a portfolio, you know, buy them and forget them. They're an asset class that you use from a defensive nature at times, knowing full well that over time there's a chance that they're going to greatly underperform. I saw this terrific chart, and it showed the real return of government bonds from 26, I think, all the way to 2019. Real return means your return after inflation. And the interesting thing was, from 1926 all the way to 1981, your real return was zero.
Wow.
Meaning that you didn't make any real money owning bonds for that period. And it wasn't until the 1981 bull market that we experienced, from that you know, 16% long bond or whatever the number was, to now, when we're basically, what are we now, 2.25, just, you know, we're at these kind of absurd levels. And yes, they could go lower. Maybe we're going to zero like the rest of the world. But I think that that's actually something that the market is, you know, doing what the market always does, which is take a trend and extrapolate it forever and assume it's going to continue without thinking about the possibilities of it changing. And I think that when you're looking at what might change in the macro environment going forward, what you should be watching for is a shift from this reliance on monetary policy to fiscal policy.
Yeah.
And I think that we're already getting signs of it. I think that I call Trump the most MMT president that we've ever had. Some people get upset about that, but I'm not trying to make a political comment. I'm trying to say that if you look at the policies that he put in place, which was putting fiscal stimulus in 8 years into an economic kind of reflation, most Keynesians would tell you at that point that you should be paying back the deficit. The Austrians would tell you you should be cranking interest rates higher because the real cost of money is much higher. But what did Trump do? He did what a typical MMTer would do, which would he said, we're going to do fiscal policy, meaning that he did some tax cuts. And when they asked him, if things are so good with the economy, why are you advocating for lower rates? He said, because there's no inflation, which is, again, an MMT response. Both of those things are kind of early warning signs about how the world is going to change going forward. And I think that the U.S. was actually at the forefront of this. And you're going to start to see countries like Germany, where, let's face it, at minus 50 basis points, that means they can go borrow and spend, and as long as they don't lose 50 basis points, their society is even off.
Yep.
It sure seems to me that they could use some fiscal spending, and that the bond markets are telling you that the governments aren't spending enough. And I think that when you see that go forward, you see this fiscal spending, you're going to see the inflation come back that everyone thinks is just so unattainable. I think we'll look back and we'll laugh at the idea that we couldn't create inflation.
Oh, I think in some ways it's laughable now. And you know, again, I'm not looking for you to endorse our investment approach, and I'm not trying to plug it, but this is one of the reasons that we've taken an incredible amount of flack about it, and I was completely expecting it. But this is one of the reasons that we've deployed these insurance products as bond alternatives, because we don't have to charge clients a fee on them. They're fee-less products, and they track stock indices, and they're guaranteed against loss. They don't give you all the upside of the stock indices. I mean, we're talking about investments that average between 5 to 6% a year. But the point is they can be the safe part of our portfolio. Again, I want to reemphasize this, in a retail portfolio, right, where we have constraints.
Right.
And a lot of our clients aren't accredited. So, you know, you've got to deal with the tools you've got. But now we've got the safe part of our portfolio, that anchor, which is what the bonds are supposed to be, and it's deriving its returns from the indexes, which should do well in an inflationary environment, and they're insured against loss. And in to us, we're sitting there looking at this, you know, and I get flack from other advisors all the time. Oh, it's those things are horrible and this or that. And I'm looking at their bond portfolio, and net of fees, a lot of these people have averaged less than 1% over the last 8 years. And it's just like you said, one of the tough things about doing this job, and you've seen more of these cycles than I have. You brought it earlier up about the dot-com bubble, and everybody sees it in retrospect. But the people that sit there and go, oh, I could have spotted dot-com bubble. Then you ask them when they bought their last house, and they're going to tell you 2006. Right. And then you ask them what's in their stock portfolio right now. And they're going to tell you Shopify and CRM, you know, Salesforce. They're going to go on down the list and you go, yeah, you really are a bubble spotter, aren't you? and you know, as far as offending people, Kev, if you can figure out a way to say something and not offend somebody, let me know. because I mean, you talk about walking through a minefield these days. It's one of the reasons I love having you on too, because you and I both know if you want to do good at this job and you want to be a good investor, leave your political ideas at the door, right? What are your thoughts on that?
For sure. If you start not investing in something because you think, oh, I don't like Trump, and therefore I don't like his policies, so I'm going to sell the stock market, you would have missed the rally of the last, 2 years, one of the best rallies we've ever had.
Yep.
So I contend that leave those things aside. If you want to do good with your money, you know, go give to a charity and change the world that way. But in terms of your investments, it's our obligation to figure out what's going up and to get long that, and to figure out what's going down and make sure we're not long those.
Yeah.
And so I don't really care why it is. I wouldn't go and invest in something that was killing you know, puppies or something like that. But at the same time, I try very hard to make sure that I don't let my beliefs about the world I want to have, the way I want the world to be, isn't the world that I'm faced with as a trader. I always say, trade the markets that are in front of you, not what you think it should be.
Yeah, boy.
And I really think that too many people let themselves, let their politics affect their investment decisions.
Yeah, yeah. What another one you brought up earlier? Kind of, I'm kind of flipping it up, and I want to get into the geopolitical discussion. But you were like, you're doing the show for me, man, because you keep bringing up these topics that I find fascinating. You know, one of the interesting things that I find now, I there's some confirmation bias built into this statement because I was managing money through the last crisis. I wasn't running money in the height of the dot-com bubble, but I was, doing stuff with my father who was running money during that period of time. And so I had a more of an up-close look at it than most people did. But one of the things I find interesting about this move, and I guess you could say Julian Robertson was one of the guys that did the same thing at the height of the last tech bubble, but you've seen a lot of these stalwarts like Bill Gross. Bill Miller has had a tough run of it. You looked at a lot of these stalwarts that have either closed down their funds or have had the worst performance of their careers. Druckenmiller said it on the Real Vision interview. What do you think it is? I mean, I've got my take on it, but what do you think it is about this cycle that has rocked so many established investors that have really, golden track records, you know, guys that have really outperformed over a long period of time? What is that?
So I think it's a few things. The one is that value stocks have gotten crushed.
Yeah.
And at their heart, most of these hedge fund guys, like take David Einhorn, he's a perfect example. He's going to be long value stocks, meaning stocks that he have some hair on them, but they're cheap, and he thinks the market's going to recognize that there's value there, and that he feels that the downside is limited. And then what they do is they sprinkle it with some shorts on the growth side, stocks that are a little too frothy, that they feel the market's overpaying for that growth. And unfortunately, in this kind of era of QE and zero interest rates and more and more easy monetary policy, we've been starved for actual real growth. So those growth stocks have just, the ones that have managed to figure out a way to grow in this environment, have continued to get more and more and more expensive.
Yeah.
In the same time, the value stocks, those that are kind of more reflective of Main Street, they're not as exciting, they're more the real economy stocks, they've also gone the other way. So they've gone cheaper and cheaper and cheaper.
Yeah.
So that's the first thing I would say, is that we've had this environment that's made it so value stocks have been crushed, and that's been a kind of a trade that has been the backbone of many hedge funds and also other kind of famous stock pickers. But then the next thing that I would argue is that I brought it up a little bit when I said QE. We hit a point where the rule book changed, and that's when we hit the zero bound on interest rates.
Yep.
And up until this point, we had always assumed that monetary policy was driving the bus. And whether it was or not, it doesn't really matter. I can tell you something for sure. Going forward, it's not driving the bus nearly as much as everyone believes. And so we take, for example, when we had the QE, the open letter to Ben Bernanke in 2010, when a lot of very famous people, a lot of hedge fund managers, very famous kind of fixed income managers signed it saying that this policy was going to cause all sorts of inflation. And yet it hasn't come. So they've been trading based upon a fundamental economic belief that is, in essence, being flawed. And I think that what we are in the process of what's happening over the last year is, as people have come to realize this and as they've examined how the economy actually really works, they've come to the conclusion that monetary policy isn't as effective as we think it is, and that basically fiscal means more, and that is change the way that stocks and the typical reaction of where you should put your money, those things broke down and made it more difficult for people. And it was only those who understood that that relationship was breaking down that were able to really, truly position themselves properly.
Yeah, and that's a great point. Now, I want to continue on this. We got to take a quick break. So, but right after, we'll pick up right where we left off. So stick with us through the break. We'll be right back with Kevin Muir. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH. All right, welcome back to the show. And if you're just joining us, we've been lucky enough to be joined by Kevin Muir, market strategist for East West Investment Management. And we're talking about the breakdown of great performers, legendary performers in this latest cycle, and what made them fall off. And you said something where you got into the value side of things, and you talked about how that hasn't worked and how value's gotten crushed. It's funny because we are very much, I'm a value guy. Now we diversify our clients' holdings. Not just with, you know, different individual positions and not just on a geographic basis, but we also do it stylistically. So we have an algorithmically driven ETF portfolio that we use that's been excellent. And it's been excellent for a very long time, did very well through the last cycle as well. And then we also have an actively managed value portfolio. And we did that because, again, one of those kind of fortuitous things, Kevin, because I never thought the winter would be this long in value. And the value side of the portfolio has struggled big time. And one of the things that I talk to clients about and investors about all the time is how it is so often that clients bail at precisely the wrong time. And I just lost a client this week. He was dismayed with the performance of the value portfolio, and it had underperformed, but it hasn't been that bad. It's been right in line with value stocks, and it only made up about 20% of his overall portfolio, but that was really the breaking point. And, you know, I just had to give him a tip of the cap and say, okay, you know, nobody likes losing assets, but it's part of the game. What I've seen is I am seeing just, it's running rampant. Everybody's throwing I shouldn't say everybody, you know, I'm talking to retail people all the time, and they're throwing the towel in on value. And they think that if they're not up to S&P performance every single year or over a quarter, that this isn't working. Switch. And I just sit there and I go, guys, where have we gotten this short-term view of investing? Why are we measuring things on a quarter-to-quarter basis? It's just crazy to me. And the other thing is value investing. I listened to a podcast by Josh Brown and Reform Broker. Yeah, he was on Tobias Carlyle's podcast. And this isn't meant as a bash against him at all. I think he's a fun, entertaining, and smart guy to listen to. I don't even disagree with him. He posited the question. Hey, maybe it is this time that it's different this time. Maybe our classic understanding of value has gone away. I answer back, and my whole thing is I go, no, it hasn't. And that's what everybody says. Go look at the cover of the magazine in 99. Is value investing dead? Had a picture of Warren Buffett, right? We've seen this movie before. Buying things for lower than their intrinsic value will always work. It might take more time, but it'll work. And when everybody's throwing in the towel, doesn't mean it's the bottom, but it's got to mean you're pretty close.
For sure. And I think that Josh, you know, positing that idea to you is a sure a sign that the bottom is probably closer than you think.
Right. Right.
And one of the, you know, you mentioned Warren Buffett. A lot of people don't realize this, but if you go look at his stock performance in the 90s, late 98, he got halved.
Oh, it was brutal.
Right? And I remember articles about how the old man, because he's old even back then, had lost his touch. And how he wasn't, he didn't understand the new economy and that you should sell all that and buy Jim Cramer's The Six Horsemen or whatever. And so it's his oldest time, this this kind of idea that styles like value go out of favor, and the fact that Josh Brown's telling you that it's probably this time is different is the best sign that this time isn't different, and it's just a sign that we might need a little more pain before it finally kicks in. Another famous one was Julian Robertson. He was a famous hedge fund manager that managed Tiger Global. He closed his firm right in the depths of the value stock in 99-2000 because he couldn't take it anymore either.
Yeah.
So I've always kind of joked maybe we need Einhorner, a famous value manager of our generation, to throw in the towel for the to signify the bottoms there.
Yeah, what I'd like to hear is Tobias Carlyle come out and say that he's going to start chasing growth stocks, because which he'll never do. But if he did that, I would just go in and buy everything that was even closely related to value. That would be the ultimate signal.
That's right.
The other side of it, too, is you brought it up. You brought up the housing crash. And you brought up the guys that were shorting housing. And I totally get why this is so unnerving and why so few investors and so few clients can stomach it. It takes a stomach of iron. Burry talks about how he developed an ulcer during that whole thing. It is unbelievably tough to do. But you've been through more battles, more wars than I have. It has been my experience, not fun, but my experience, that almost universally, if I think back through it, the best trades, the best investments I ever made typically started out ugly, because rarely can you bottom tick something. And usually, if you're buying something that has been rocked, market momentum and sentiment will carry it further than any. And you were talking about this in the bond side of it, too, right? It's good. The trend is always going to go farther than it should because of
right.
What George Soros called the reflexivity. So if you're a smart investor and you're buying something at intrinsic value and you've done good work, vast majority of chances on the value side of things anyway, you're going to get it before it's bottomed. And those have been, without question, our best investments. Would you echo that sentiment?
Oh, I 100% agree. I'll let you know on a dirty little secret about my newsletter. When everyone writes me to tell me how wrong I am, I thank them for their concern about my position, and then I double it.
Yeah.
Because the reality is that if think about what makes a good investment. What does Jim Grant say? A good investment is buying something that has value, which everyone else figures out later.
Right. Right.
And if it's obvious today, then how is it going to get better going forward? And if everyone's already bought it, why am I buying it? Because isn't that all the way in the market? Like, even now, let's talk about what's happening. We're taping this Friday afternoon. There's all sorts of news about the Trump trade deal and stuff. By the time this gets out, do you really want to be buying it? Like, I would contend that the market's going to fully price it in almost by that stage.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I agree, which is why we jacked some things around in our portfolio yesterday. But I'll echo that sentiment. Again, you never want to lose a client. This client was a great guy. Got along with him famously. But I did, after getting done going back and forth with him a little bit, I did kind of push away from the desk and smile to myself a little bit and go, okay, we're getting closer to a bottom. Everybody's throwing in the towel. And, you just know that's the way it works. The other side of it is it's interesting about investing. In many ways, it's like life. If your goal is to outperform, you have to know inherently that you will go through periods of time of underperformance, and they're probably going to be fairly large, sizable sometimes. You cannot do it. I mean, The Big Short, you brought it up. What was Burry's fund down something like 46% in 2007 while he was waiting for that thing to pop? Something like that. It's just part of the game. Again, you can speak to it better than I can, but it's part of the game.
Well, here's another example. So there's been a big trend towards passive indexing. And although I understand the reasons for it, if you look at the idea that you market cap weight the indexes, it's kind of doesn't really make much sense. I guess it makes sense if you're kind of CalPERS or teachers or somebody big that needs to put a lot of money to work. But for the average investor, why don't we equal weight the indexes? So if you go look over a period of many decades, you'll notice that an equal weight index actually outperforms a market weight index. And so what happens is you aren't buying those kind of heavy top, heavy names, and you're being invested over a broader array of stocks more equally, right? Because if you think about market cap, I think some right now, something like the top six represent 30% of the index. It's some absurdly high number. And then by equal weight, that means Amazon is the same weighting as the 500 stock in the S&P 500.
Yeah.
So you say to yourself, well, if this works over the long run, why is the S&P 500 the most popular ETF, and why don't people buy an equal weight S&P 500 index? And the reality is because there's periods of massive underperformance. That relationship is very similar to the relationship of value versus growth.
Yep.
So although over time the equal weight does better, there are periods where you'll be outperforming by significant amounts. And so people go and they end up, saying, I can't take that sort of underperformance for that sort of periods of time. My favorite story about people taking money away from good managers is Jeremy Grantham likes to tell the story. He's the famous value manager from GMO. And he says that if you look at his performance over the years, he's got like a great Sharpe ratio, which is a risk-adjusted return. He's consistently outperformed the market. But if he looks at the amount of money he's taken out of the market, meaning like his actual performance in dollars, he says it's not nearly as high. In fact, it's actually not as good because all my clients take money away from me at the worst time.
Yes, yes. We pound the table on this all the time, and especially on the retail. Man, you're hitting all the points today, Kev. You are on. You're just on point, man. I shouldn't be surprised, but but you're throwing pearls here. Okay, so one of the things that we pound the table on all the time is we go through our spiel and the client's like, why do we do it this way? And I look at them and I go, guys, you got to understand something. These portfolios are designed to keep your business. They're not designed necessarily to make you rich. Okay, they're in the business of collecting fees, and I'm not insinuating that these firms are nefarious or they're trying, but they've got to keep you invested. And why don't they sell you the equal weighted stuff? Because like you said, there are going to be these periods of time where it's underperforming, even if they know it's going to do well. And then some other schmuck financial advisor is going to come around and go, your manager doesn't know what he's doing. You're only up 2%. The S&P's up 11. What an idiot. If you came over here, and they're going to lose the account. If you want to know why you don't have the best stuff or the best performance in your account, it's because they're trying to keep your business, and they know the easiest way for you to get cherry-picked is underperforming the index, so they're just going to give it to you. And then when it crashes, they're going to look at you and go, man, it's the market, man. You got to ride it out. And then when it's up, they're going to stick their chest out and go, see, we told you. This is the right way to go about it.
And see, this is actually the individual investor's one actual advantage over institutional money.
Yeah.
Institutional money cannot afford to underperform because that manager will have his money taken away from him the moment he does it. So institutional money is very geared towards that month or that quarter, and they're always chasing the latest fad, and the moment that they underperform, they have to kind of change their strategy and make sure that they're long all those the stocks that are going up. And an individual investor has the advantage of time. They can sit through a period of outperformance knowing that that strategy is a good, valid strategy and will do well over time. And so that they're not chasing and getting long, you know, those growth names right at the top, and instead are sticking with a strategy that makes sense.
Yeah.
You know, I have this other great study that we went through, and we went through over the past 80 years, and you looked at $1 and into various different strategies, and I'll just kind of read you very quickly the returns. $1 or sorry, I'll give you the annualized returns, and then we'll talk about what that means in dollars. Over these eight decades, U.S. government long bonds were 5.6%, corporate bonds were 5.9%, the U.S. small cap growth was 8.8%. Large cap growth was 9.6. The S&P 500 was 10.3. Large cap value was 12.5, and small cap value was 15.2. That's the annualized return over these eight decades.
Value.
So one of the things is, if you look at $1, you put a dollar in 1927 in that bond index, and what are you left with? You've got $134. If you put it into corporate bonds, you get $200. If you're in the small cap growth, you get $1,700. Now, we'll go to the S&P 500. After those 80 years, your $1 is worth $6,000. That sounds pretty good, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But then you realize that if you go to large cap value, which was 12.5%, you're actually more than doubling it. You're at $13,500. And here's the really kicker one. The U.S. small cap value index, which annualized 15.2, that same dollar that the S&P was only worth $6,000, that same dollar in the small cap value is worth $78,000.
And guess what? Guess what segment hurt us over the last 16 months? Do you have a guess?
Small cap value.
You got it. You got it.
Right. And that's why it's important. The reason that that is so difficult is because people can't stay in them.
Yep.
And otherwise, if it really was that easy, then everyone would be in it.
Oh, and it's not. And that's what I try to tell clients. I go, listen, I get it. I'm a fee-based guy. I don't like underperforming. You know, and I'm like, we're all competitive. I mean, I don't think you can last in this industry if you're not competitive. But that's the whole game. We've got to endure the painful times to get the payday. And it's just, that's the other really nefarious part of this whole passive indexing model. And like I said, we use a form of it. Ours is managed, and it's got different aspects to it, and risk mitigating parts of it, obviously. But that to me is the nefarious thing, because you ask client how they're doing, and everybody thinks that they're really smart now comparing their performance to the S&P 500. And I go, well, hold on a second. Did that feel good in 2009? Did that feel good in 2008? Right? Like, it's of course you want to own what just went up. I mean, that's what everybody does. But we don't have the, you know, we're not driving in the rear, you know, we're driving in the rear view mirror. We don't have the benefit of hindsight. And it's going to work. It's going to turn. And it'll come. It doesn't mean it's fun, though.
I will tell you one thing about the passive debate. I hear a lot of value managers complaining about passive, and or guys trying to tell me that it's the end of the world and it's going to cause the next crisis. I kind of feel like that's crying over spoiled milk. Like,
yep.
It's if you're a true value guy and everyone's investing in the index, it's only making your stocks cheaper and making forward returns all the better.
Makes it harder to keep clients.
Sure it does, but the market will correct. It will figure it out. As this is just the way markets go. They take things too far, and then it gets arbitraged away the other way.
Yep. No.
So I look at this passive debate, and I think it's ridiculous. I think that anybody that's complaining about like an active manager or a value guy that's complaining about passive, they should shake their heads, because the more that people do passive, the more easy their job gets, because the cheaper the stocks become that are not in the index.
Hey, Kev, I've done it. I'll plead guilty. It hasn't.
You plead guilty. About the bathroom guy.
Yeah.
Well,
no.
I think you should. I think that a better way to approach it is that Jesse Felder, a guy from your neck of the woods, he went about and said, "Listen, I'm going to go try to find stocks that are cheap." And I think he came to the conclusion that if you had a company that had a founder that owned a large percentage of the stock,
yep,
then that wasn't eligible for inclusion in the index because it was a control block. And so he went and made himself a portfolio of stocks that were run by founders that owned control blocks. And he's finding that those are the kind of values that he can find because of the opportunities.
Yeah, no, we use it. We look at that. We also use a little bit is some different things that we're looking at to compose our value portfolio. But when I say I plead guilty to it, it hasn't been for quite some time. And one of the reasons for that is I had an incredibly profound coach in college, legendary coach, won four national titles, football coach, 10th winningest coach in NCAA history, and all the guys before him, the nine that had a better had more wins than he did, I believe on average they coached something like 12 to 15 years longer than he did. So the guy was he was incredible. And he used to always sit there, and he had so much wisdom. So, you know, incredible guy, Frosty Westring. And actually, his grandson is with me in studio right now and works with us at our firm. But he used to tell us all the time, you know, guys, quit worrying about the outputs. Focus on the inputs. That's all we can control. If we do the right things, the outcomes will take care of themselves. If we stay disciplined and stick to our program, that's all we can control. Stick to the process and don't run around chasing, you know, don't be like the dog in the, you know, he didn't say this, but don't be like the dog in the movie that, you know, squirrel in the middle of the conversation, looking all over the place. And I look at this value the same thing. Like, look, we're sticking to it because we know it's the best thing for you. And that's the promise that we made. And our single goal is not to keep your business, right? It's to fulfill our fiduciary duty. And it's not fun. It's not fun. Nobody wants to underperform for a while, but you got to take it. If you want to outperform over the long run, you got to be willing to take the heat. And that's when I got off it, Kev. That's when I sat there and said, you know what? I'm tired of griping about this, because if it is as influential as everybody is saying it is, then it's like you said, the flip side of that coin is there's incredible opportunities out there. If it is as bad as everybody is claiming it, then there has to be anomalies on the other side. Right?
Yeah, I completely agree. This is one of my other pet peeves, is the idea that everyone says, oh, if I was around when you were around, when computers were just coming up in the markets, I would have made so much money. And I was like, no, it wasn't that easy. The majority of people didn't know how to use computers. I was lucky because I was a little more technologically advanced, and there was a good opportunity there. But the reality was that it was difficult to adapt to these new kind of computerized markets. And I'll admit that although I took advantage of it in the 90s and the early 2000s, I didn't adapt quickly enough, and I found myself falling behind the HFT guys. And although some HFT guys I do believe are nefarious in that they're just front-running orders, which I think is not really doesn't make society any better.
Agreed.
There's also other guys out there that are doing statistical arbitrage, like Renaissance Technologies. These guys somehow find ways to put up 100% returns year after year on size.
Yeah.
And this is my point, is that there's always opportunities out there. It's just that they're always difficult to spot. And it's only, as you say, with the benefit of hindsight, that you realize how you could have taken advantage of it. And so there's opportunities now. And maybe that's going to be the fact that they're giving away value stocks. And we're going to look back and say, why was everyone rushing into Google, Amazon, Facebook, Microsoft when there was mom and pop's, you know, main economy stocks that you could buy on the exchange dirt cheap that nobody wanted?
Yeah, well, to keep clients, that's why. And they're
not. Yeah, but you know, ultimately doing the right thing over and over again, like you say, is important. And your football coach that says the process matters more, it's an interesting thing. And one of, you know, I am also a little bit of a short-term trader. And so I talk to guys from the CME, like that used to be futures traders that are now trading upstairs. And one of the things they say is take the P&L off the screen.
Yeah.
They tell them, don't worry about the P&L. Just be true to your process.
Yep.
And they say, don't focus on the outcome, focus on the process. And I think that the point that I bring that up is, I think that that is applicable probably not just over multiple time frames and multiple different strategies, but it might even be just applicable in life.
Oh, dude, you couldn't have hit the nail more on the head. And whenever my key to it in, truthfully, Kev, raising my children, my marriage, managing money, whenever that frustration or that, you know, that comes up, look, I'm not perfect, obviously, and I don't always listen to it, but whenever that anger or frustration comes up, I always sit there and think to myself, the minute you give this breath, the minute you give this life, or you pay attention to this frustration, or you act on it, you are now focusing on the outcome and you are not focusing on the input. And moreover, You've lost your edge because you're not seeing clearly, right? The emotions are now clouding it, and that's what's guiding your decision, as opposed to thinking long term and sticking with your process and being disciplined. And like you said, guide to life too, right? I mean, it's yeah. not just training.
Well, and this is the problem with people see other people getting rich off of these like growth names, and Bitcoin's a perfect example. You see all these people, you know, getting rich off Bitcoin, and you go, I gotta have some. And you and that tendency for, you know, I don't know, I guess it's the keeping up with the Joneses, or the feeling that someone else isn't getting rich, I mean, is getting rich without you, really bothers people. And that's why, in essence, you get these bubbles, you know, in different asset classes or different sectors of the economy.
Yeah. Okay, now, I think that was... I enjoyed the heck out of it. I hope the listeners do. But before we leave, you're a busy guy that's got stuff to do. I'd be remiss if we didn't hit up what's going on in macroeconomics. Now, I was a bit shocked to hear that that the macro tourist himself had all of a sudden. Now, I know that you're, and I don't mean this flip flop, but you know, you follow the data. You're going to change your opinion when the facts change. You made more of a bearish turn recently. Can you walk us through that and kind of lay the groundwork for where you're at?
For sure. I've been bullish for a long time, and I've kind of been pushing back against all these hedge funds that have been bearish on the market. And I've continued to believe that there was the U.S. market could climb a wall of worry. And I was like, no, you have to stay long. And yeah, we're going to have little moments of problems. But ultimately, I think we were headed higher. And I recently got to the point where I felt almost uncomfortable that people were agreeing with me, Zach. I feel better when everyone tells me I'm wrong.
You and me both.
And the reason that I came down to it, there's a variety of different things. One of them was this kind of repo problem that we had with the money markets getting tighter, and we had a spike in overnight rates. And a lot of people will tell me, oh, it's technical in nature, and you know, we could go into the reasons for it. I do understand the reasons, but at the end of the day, I kind of believe that we had gone 9 years without this spike in rates and without this being a problem, and now all of a sudden there's a problem. It's a symptom that something's changing and that the world might be a little more off-kilter than we think. Yep. In terms of the plumbing of the financial news system. The other issue that I have is that Jim Bianco had this terrific chart, and it showed policy rates throughout the world, and it showed the periods when the U.S. had, as a percentage of how many other countries the U.S. was higher than. Like that the policy rate was higher than. So if, you know, if the policy rate was in the middle, that it would correspond to 50%. And then if it was in the top third, it would be 66% or whatever. Like it was something of that nature. And then he showed the times that it spiked, meaning that the times when the U.S. was the highest policy rate throughout the world. And these all corresponded to periods of economic global problems.
Yep.
And it was 2006, it was 99, it was like, and even when you go back and you see in the 70s, there was other periods like this. And this comes down to the U.S. being the world's central banker. And the Federal Reserve, although they don't want the job, they are the central banker to the world. And the reality is that when Powell went and raised rates and pushed them up, and don't forget he's like that infamous, we're a long way from neutral, he caused an economic slowdown, and especially in outside of the U.S., and we finally hit a point where the idea that the U.S. is that famous line about the cleanest shirt in the dirty laundry pile, I think that it no longer holds water, in that we're hitting the U.S., we're finding the U.S. economy is actually slowing down with the rest of the world. And although I still think America is one of the strongest, most dynamic, you know, economies in the world, it has more to do with what the price of that asset is that I'm paying for that.
Right.
And I just think that everyone has what they priced in, what everyone sees in front of them, which is the fact that they were the only growth in town. And they've priced it, they've taken it too far, and now we're in a situation where the U.S. is rolling over economically. And I'm not predicting a 2008-style collapse, but I just believe that at the margin, the stocks are priced for perfection. Combine that with my worry about those top six stocks that are very growth-oriented, and another sign, a symptom of this kind of maybe the bloom coming off the rose is the WeWork IPO. The fact that failed, and that these big, huge unicorns and tri-unicorns or deca unicorns or whatever they call them, they're having to get repriced. We might be finally hitting the point where the market realizes that U.S. stocks are probably fully priced, and that over the next little while they're going to underperform.
I couldn't agree with you, and I think that I think that. Monetary policy has certainly lost steam. Where we're at exactly in that curve, I don't know. I mean, I definitely think the efficacy of it is waning, to say the least. But when you take a step back and you look at everything, who knows? Maybe it's like you said. I don't really foresee a 2008-2009 type scenario. But I think you could see some really nasty markets. I think you could see this volatility that we've seen over the last 2 years continue. And I think you could see things like value starkly outperform while the index goes sideways with a negative bias for an extended period of time. And
I couldn't agree with you more, Zach. That's in essence what I'm calling for. A grind lower in the index as a whole that has some really painful kind of switches within the different value groups.
Well, yeah, and one of the things that, and I wanted to run this by you while I had you on here, one of the things that brought me to that realization, it's been very hard for me to admit to myself and to process mentally, and I even hate saying it because it seems foolish, but when you've got central banks playing the role that they have played, I think that there are maybe 4 to 6 different times over the last cycle that without central banks having the spigot wide open, we could have had an epic crash, and we probably would have. But we have to look at, you know, all the crashes that we've experienced, in essence. Now, they've had different causes, different things, but the painful aspect of it was a liquidity crunch at some point. And that is the one thing that monetary policy at this point. Now, it's going to come to a point where it can't do this. I still can't quite get my hands around, you know, outside of massive inflation, you know, what would create that, you know, that would tie their hands, if you will. But for those sitting around waiting for a 2008 liquidity crunch type crash, I hate to break it to them, but if you're willing to throw trillions of dollars at any given market at any given time, I think that's the one thing that they can stop from happening. Right. A lack of liquidity is not going to be what brings down, at least not in the foreseeable future. I realize that some people sit there and go, what on earth is this guy saying that this time is different? Well, yeah, to a degree it is. Nobody cares about deficits or debt anymore. I mean, central banks, I mean, look at the $22 trillion they've created out of thin air. If these guys don't want a liquidity crisis, that is one thing they can prevent, can they not?
Oh, I 100% agree. And you said this time is different. Well, the reality is that every crisis, every financial crisis is different.
Right.
And everyone, I remember in the dot-com bubble afterwards, we were sitting around worried about tech stocks going down again.
Right.
And nobody bid tech, you know, during 2000, the bull market from 2003 or whatever to 2008, we didn't bid tech stocks up because the reality is everyone was worried about it.
Well, remember in 2007, this market isn't crashing. Look at the P.E. ratio. We're not overvalued, right? They were still playing from the last playbook.
So I think that every crisis is different, and I would contend even that one of the value areas for your economy and your country is housing.
Yeah. Yeah.
I look at it, and I know a lot of people will tell me, oh, no, it's run a long way. I think they're looking at the one percenters. They're looking at the gateway markets, the LAs, Miami, New York's, all those fancy markets. But the rest of the U.S., is the housing is dirt cheap. And if you're looking for somewhere to hide, I actually think that your housing and housing stocks are some of the better places to go.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and the other one, it's been a house of pain, but boy, is there some value in retail. You know, you're a pariah if you say it. Oh, retail, there is some interesting value in retail. And, you know, it's not like we've gone all in because, look, you know, it's clear that the internet companies and the platform companies that everybody talks about so much, look, they're certainly changing the retail landscape. I mean, that's undeniable. But to think that there are going to be no more brick and mortar retailers left, I mean, come on. You know,
yeah.
There are going to be some that make it. Now, really quick, so do you think, what does this portend for the rest of the world? Do you think this value gap then between the rest of the world and the U.S., which is, I mean, it's at historic proportions. Do you think that's going to close, or do you think that the other markets, well, I mean, shoot, I guess they really can't. I mean, well, you can always drop more, but do you think that gap between the valuations of U.S. markets and all the other markets out there, do you think that's going to close? Is that going to tighten?
Yes. I think that the rest of the world is going to realize the folly of their ways. They tried to combat the fiscal stimulus of Trump with monetary easing, and in doing so made the pain all the worse, sent their currency down, sent their economies down. It was just madness of epic proportions, and I think they've realized that that's not going to occur anymore. And as they go and fix that policy and slowly rotate back to fiscal and hopefully raise rates, you're going to see a situation where things like Europe, I suspect, the euro will rally, the European stocks will rally. I know that's a very out of consensus view. Most people will tell you how Europe's going to collapse and it's going to end in a deflationary mess. That could be, listen, but if they do that, it would be the first country or block in history that succumbed from deflation instead of inflation.
Right.
I always say this to people, name me a country that's collapsed because of deflation. They can't name any, but you sure can name a lot that have collapsed from inflation. So I look for these countries to realize that this road down the monetary policy, you know, easing is wrong. And as they do that, they will create the inflation. They will create some outperformance. And don't get me wrong, they will eventually abuse it and cause inflation. But that's a long way from now. And in the meantime, there's some money to be made on the long side of their equity market and currency market.
Yeah, and I think in time, financial history will see the act of central bankers and their deathly, their horrible fear of deflation. I think it will be seen as one of the epic out of the frying pan into the fire decisions of all time because of what you just said. Deflation can create some ugly times. Inflation blows apart empires and kills countries.
Yeah.
And this embracing of inflation, and I get it. I studied economics in college. I get it. But it's so poetic, right? We're running toward the very thing that's really going to cause carnage and going to create political upheaval.
And the main thing is that most investors aren't ready for it. And
no.
That's why it's going to be especially painful.
Oh, yeah, because, Kev, what's the book, man? As we get older and we get less risk tolerant, we load up more on bonds. And
Yeah. If
you want to know how they perform during an inflationary cycle, go look at the bond performance in the U.S. alone from 1968 to 1984. It was a absolute bloodbath.
They called it the certificates of confiscation.
Yeah, that's right.
That's what bonds used to be called.
But nobody remembers it. Our memories are so short. And unfortunately, I think that's just a human trait, right?
For sure. What's that cartoon? For those who don't remember, those who don't read history are doomed to repeat it. And those who do read it are doomed to watch those who haven't read it repeat it.
Yeah, right. Oh, man. Boy, doesn't that feel prescient these days? Well, anyway, hey, pal, I know you got to run. As always, blast to have you on. I love running things by you and love your take on things. And I'd encourage everybody, give him a follow at Kevin Muir on Twitter, M-U-I-R. It's not like you need any followers, though, because you've really gone, you've gone big time on us, Kev. You're all over the place, man.
I still always love my Seattle followers. So, they're near and dear to my heart.
Well,
you guys are almost Canadian.
Yeah. You know, well, what are you talking about? How was that? I've been working on that one for you, man. Anyway, hey, Kev, thank you so much for coming on. Have a fantastic weekend. And as always, man, I look forward to chatting and mixing it up with you again. And all the best between now and the next time we chat.
Well, thank you very much. It's always a pleasure being with you, Zach.
All right, pal. Have a good one. And thank you guys so much for joining us. We will be back, as always, next week. And we'll talk to you then. This is Know Your Risk Radio on AM 770 KTTH.